From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are just hours away from NASA's launch of a spacecraft that would be the first of its kind to fly into the outer atmosphere of the sun. The Parker Solar Probe will scream through space at up to 430,000 miles per hour as it approaches the sun's fiery corona. We assume this mission is peaceful, even though it comes one day after the White House announced its plan to create a space force in the U.S. military. Joining us now is NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield-Boyce and NPR science editor Jeff Brumfield. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
And Nell, let me start with you and the Parker Solar Probe. How close to the sun will it get, and what does NASA want to learn from it?
So it will come within 4 million miles of the sun's surface, and that may not sound very close, but it's 7 times closer than any spacecraft has come before. And basically, this is a region that's very dynamic. There's a lot of charged particles being sent out and magnetic fields, and NASA basically wants to understand what's going on there and how it could affect Earth and the other planets.
I assume that one of the reasons this has not been done before is that it's going to be very difficult to have a spacecraft survive the 2,500 degree Fahrenheit heat that you can get to close to the sun. How is it going to do that without burning up?
So that is the issue, and that's why it's been 60 years in the making. NASA's been thinking about this for 6 decades. And basically, it's got this really cool heat shield that's made of this carbon composite. It's kind of a foam. It looks almost like that florist foam that you, like, shove flowers into. It looks and feels like that, but it protects against the heat.
And this is named after Eugene Parker, who is one of the first scientists to study solar wind back in the 1950s. He is still alive. How big of a milestone is this, Nell?
I think it's a big deal because the sun is our closest star. It's really the only star that we have a hope of in studying this way. And keep in mind, almost all life on Earth depends on the sun.
Right.
And so NASA's never been able to get this close and take this kind of look before.
Okay. Now, Jeff, I said that we assume this mission is peaceful. It sounds like it probably is.
You don't want to start a war with the sun.
With the sun, right.
You're going to lose.
But what about this idea of a space force? This is Vice President Pence announcing this plan to create a sixth branch of the military if Congress approves it.
And while too often previous administrations all but neglected the growing security threats emerging in space, President Trump stated clearly and forcefully that space is, in his words, a war-fighting domain just like land and air and sea.
Now, today, the astronaut Buzz Aldrin, who walked on the moon, said a space force was one giant leap in the right direction. But there are also people who are worried about this as moving towards militarization of space. What would a space force do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is it's not going to be soldiers in jetpacks zipping around. I mean, the military is already in space in a big way. Weather satellites, recon satellites, communication, GPS is actually a military system. And all of this is mostly run by the Air Force at the moment. And so what President Trump and yesterday Vice President Pence are talking about is moving that out into a separate branch of the military, a Space Force.
The late night shows had a field day with this news. This is Stephen Colbert last night.
But there's no threat in space. Who are we fighting? Satellites? A bunch of frozen monkeys? Elon Musk's convertible? I mean, why not just build a space wall while we're at it?
So people are making fun of it there, Jeff, but how serious is the security threat? We already know that China and Russia are already threatening U.S. satellites in space.
Well, they're not threatening them at the moment, but what they are doing is developing anti-satellite capability. That is the ability to incapacitate or knock out or jam our satellites. And they have good reason to. The U.S. military, of all the sort of militaries in the world, uses space more than anyone else. So there is a threat there. But some of the experts I spoke to yesterday said a space force could actually be counterproductive because it gives the sense that we want to fight a war in space. You know, and actually, for the most part, we don't have offensive capabilities in space. We have support capabilities. So it may give the wrong impression. It may be the wrong message to be sending others.
I just want to bounce back to you, Nell, for 1 minute here about something that is coming up that we can all participate in, and that is to view the Perseid meteor shower this weekend. This is supposed to be especially good this year. This is the one meteor shower, by the way, where the weather is like perfect to watch it. It's not too cold to go out and watch. But what's the best way to see it?
Well, just go outside, find someplace dark, lie down, and look up at the sky. There shouldn't be much of a moon, so the conditions are really ideal. And just find someplace away from city lights if you can. Lie down, give your eyes time to adjust, and just look up, and you should be able to see them, you know, all across the sky. You don't have to look in one particular direction.
A lot of shooting stars. NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield-Boyce and NPR science editor Jeff Brumfield, thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks.
Well, President Trump tweeted earlier today that he wants to double steel and aluminum tariffs on Turkey as Turkey's national currency hit another record low during this ongoing dispute with the U.S. It's possibly another policy shift by Twitter. So let's bring in Femi Okey, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, who helps us sort through social media every week. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
So we know Trump has declared that the reliance of U.S. importers on foreign metals poses a national security risk to the U.S., lots of tariffs flying. But Turkey's currency has been steadily weakening, so Trump's first tariffs aren't hurting that much. Turkish goods are still cheaper for U.S. consumers, and so one way to fix that is to double the tariff rate. But what's happening on Twitter? What are you seeing?
So, Robin, this isn't a case of a tweet destabilizing a currency because the lira has not been in good shape for most of this year. But it is a tweet that is piling on a currency that is not doing well. So if you could draw a vertical line, that would be almost what the lira did today with its value against the dollar. Last night, Turkey's president did a speech where he's trying to rally Turks. And he's saying, if you have dollars or euros or gold under your pillow, go to the banks and exchange them for Turkish lira. And then at the bottom of the president's tweets, and that's President Trump's tweet, he says, our relations with Turkey are not good at this time.
You think?
And then, exactly, Turkish tweeps are underneath that tweet having a conversation with the President of the United States. And they are saying things like, if they have their dollars, we have our God, which is also resonating from a speech that the Turkish president actually made last night. I'm using Twitter Translate. So this might not be an exact translation, but it gives you a sense of how things bad things are and how Turks are now on U.S. Twitter talking to the president of the United States because they are not happy with this trade war that's going on. Behind all of that, there is a debate between the U.S. and Turkey about a U.S. pastor. His name is Andrew Brunson, and he is in prison right now in Turkey on terrorism charges. So there's a bigger picture behind all of this tit for tat and tweets.
This is amazing, though, that Turks are speaking with the president of the United States through
directly.
Twitter. It's amazing. Okay, so there's that. We also want to touch on the fact that the Slovenia-born parents of First Lady Melania Trump are now U.S. citizens. They take advantage of the same policy that President Trump has vowed to end. He calls it chain migration, so do critics of it, but it is known as family reunification. It is legal. American citizens can obtain residency then for their relatives. They have to apply, do the paperwork, but they can. And Melania's parents' lawyers say they went through the same process as everyone else, which, of course, their son-in-law thinks is wrong, that process. What are you seeing?
So what I'm seeing is a tweet from the President of the United States. It goes back to November 2017, where he says in all caps, chain migration, end of all caps, must end now. That is miraculously popping up just about now. And then people are just pointing out the hypocrisy of what the president has been saying, but what the first lady has actually been doing, which is all totally legal. Her parents were permanent residents, green card holders. So it's a very natural process to go from green card to then actually a citizen. It takes some time, but that's very natural. So it's the hypocrisy of the situation or the conversation between the president and what's really happening in his family life that people are picking up on.
Now, Femi, I just want to get to the fact that this weekend marks the one-year anniversary of that deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Indeed.
White nationalists, Jason Kessler is their organizer, planning to march again in Washington, D.C., the Unite the Right rally, expected to be smaller than Charlottesville. But what are you seeing? There's a far-left activist who are doing a counter-protest as well, but what are you seeing?
Even if you're not going to be in Washington, D.C. for this weekend, you will see the protests, the counter-protests, the protests happening online. Airbnb says it will ban users who use their site to take part in the Washington, D.C. Unite the Right rally. They actually call it a white supremacist Unite the Right rally. There are conversations right now about the phrase white anxiety. People were saying, this isn't white anxiety, let's just call it how we believe it to be, and that is racism. And so this debate, Make America Great Again, Unite the Right, Black Lives Matter, I'm seeing all of this online. So wherever you stand on this, you will find your views mirrored.
Yeah. Well, and
we should
say as well, Spike Lee's new film, Black Klansman, is opening this weekend.
And what timing?
Because he closes it out with the Charlottesville rally and asked the mother of Heather Heyer, the young girl who was killed there, if he could use the real footage from that in the film.
Oh, my goodness.
So all of this is going to be going on this weekend. Femi Oke, thanks for giving us the heads up. We can go to social media to track some of it. Femi Oke, host of The Stream
Al
Jazeera English. Thank you.
Take care.
Documentary filmmaker Michael Moore just released a trailer for his new film Fahrenheit 11/9. The title refers to the day that Donald Trump was declared the winner of the 2016 presidential election, an event which Moore views as catastrophic.
How the f*** did this happen?
The American dream is dead. Stop resisting.
The president's powers here are beyond question.
Ladies and gentlemen, the last president of the United States.
The title, Fahrenheit 11/9, recalls Michael Moore's biggest hit, Fahrenheit 9/11. That film, which took on President George W. Bush and the so-called War on Terror, is the highest-grossing documentary of all time. With Fahrenheit 11/9, Michael Moore seeks to spur the American people to vote against Donald Trump and the Republican Party, as he told Real Time host Bill Maher last June.
I'm finishing my movie and getting it out before the midterms because I want millions of people to get to the polls.
Michael Moore's crusade against Donald Trump was also at the center of his 2017 one-man show on Broadway, along with stories of his own life. I went to see that show last fall and spoke with Michael Moore afterwards. I began by asking him why he wanted to do a show on Broadway.
Because Broadway, this theater is about 10, 12 blocks from Trump Tower. I wanted to come to the city that gave us Donald J. Trump. I live in Michigan, and we want to know just what happened here. You guys had 40 years in New York City. I don't know if you're from New York.
But I'm not from. I'm from the Midwest. Like
oh, you are. So, oh, yeah. Where are you from?
From Champaign-Urbana.
Champaign-Urbana. Oh, that's a wonderful place to go watch a losing football team.
for my whole life.
But look, New York is the capital of liberal America. And the liberal establishment and the Democratic Party has really failed much of us who live out there in the Midwest, in the Brexit states. And I wanted to come here and speak to the people of this area, and especially the people of I see every night in a Broadway theater, because we need them.
But some would wonder, why do you want to talk to those people? Are you preaching to the choir?
Yes, I am definitely preaching to this choir. This choir has been out running around doing the wrong kinds of things that have left us completely out of power. We're the majority of this country. The majority of Americans agree with us on all the issues. Name the issue, whether it's equal pay for women, climate change, gun control, death penalty. You know, the majority of Americans take the liberal position. And yet we hold no power as we sit here right now. We don't have the White House. We don't have the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court. 50 of our state capitals, the Democrats control only 6 of them. That is unacceptable considering that we are the majority of this country. So I am here to give the choir a song to sing. I am here to challenge people who work in liberal media, who work for the Democratic Party. I mean, so much good emanates from this city to the rest of the country and the world. We need the people here first and foremost on board.
How did you know Trump was going to win? Because you famously predicted this last summer, 2016, the summer of 2016.
I had too many people tell me in Michigan who had voted for Obama that they were going to vote for Trump. It was shocking at first. I mean, like, are you kidding me? And some people voted for Obama twice. So I know all these people, they're not racist. They're not being drawn to Trump through that. You know, they're not misogynists. So what is going on here? Well, they're angry and upset. And they felt that the system had failed them, the Democratic Party had failed them, and they were going to toss a Molotov cocktail by the name of Donald J. Trump into the system and blow it. I heard that enough through the spring and summer, it was clear to me that he had an excellent chance of winning. Plus, his rallies were getting a lot more people, a lot, and the enthusiasm level. I think that's what I really noticed. I could tell that the people that were going to vote for Trump were going to bring 10 people to the polls with them.
Hmm.
The people voting for Hillary were kind of like, yeah, I'm going to vote for Hillary.
And you think he'll be reelected?
I think there's an excellent chance he'll be reelected because, again, elected by the Electoral College. We will get even a higher a popular vote in 2020. But that won't matter if he holds his base and if he holds these three Electoral College states that he won with, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Too many liberals and Democrats right now are thinking, oh, no way, that can't happen. Don't forget, George W. Bush was a two-term president. Nobody thought that was going to happen. This man can be a two-term Trump, and you should live every day assuming that that's going to happen. And if that happens, if he goes to January of 2025, that's at least three more Supreme Court appointments, and then that's it for the rest of ours and our kids' lives.
Does this feel different to you than the Bush years when you were doing things like Fahrenheit 9/11?
That's a good question. Yes, it's different in this respect. When I spoke out against Bush and the Iraq war after the war started, I had very little support. I never could have, for instance, come to Broadway and been able to do this show.
Hmm.
I mean, Bush had a 70% approval rating. The war had a 70% approval rating. Trump doesn't have that. So I now sense and feel that there's obviously a lot more people that I'm in agreement with and agree with me. And I guess one way it feels, it doesn't feel so lonely.
Hmm. You say that you think that Trump is going to take the nation to war. Why do you
absolutely.
Think that?
I mean, he's so easy to read. He's easily distracted himself, and he easily distracts us. And he is going to need us to be distracted because when and if any of those committees in Congress or Mueller's investigation bears any fruit, I fully expect him to either try taking us to war or doing that awful thing he did during the campaign when he would not ever once say he would accept the election results if he lost. He said, you know, if Hillary wins, I'm not quoting exactly, but something to the effect of he calls upon his Second Amendment people.
It's going to be rigged.
Yeah, it's going to be rigged. He kept saying that. And it was a code to say to his people, especially his armed followers, you know, be ready to go into the streets. If it looks like he's actually going to be removed while he's still president, that he will not go quietly.
You had a Q&A after the show, and somebody asked you a question about the media and the coverage of Trump and said that the media shouldn't be covering Trump as much as they are. What do you think about that? I mean, he is the president of the United States, and I think a lot of people in the media feel they need to be covering him all the time, covering everything that he does.
I think it's important to cover. I wish the media would cover more of the things we don't know about, like what happened today in any of his federal agencies, the little directives from mid-level managers that are going to end up costing us either huge sums of money or going to poison the environment or whatever that is. That's what I'd like to know. What I'd like, and I think what a lot of people would like the media to stop doing, is focusing so much on his nonsensical behavior and giving him that megaphone when he wants to go after Mika Brzezinski. That took up at least 2 days of everybody on the media just constantly talking about him attacking a morning host on MSNBC. I think that's what people are just sick and tired of. And we'd actually rather know the stuff we don't know for the media to actually dig more and do more. But that takes money and that takes hardcore investigative reporting. That is the job we do need you to do.
One of the criticisms of you, and I've seen it about this show, is that you are saying things that people want to hear, but you make it about you. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I know. I'm the only one on the stage. So it's a little, it is true. I am the only one up there. I probably should have had 50 or 60 other characters on the stage, and it would have been less about me. If you're going to do a one-man show, that's such an odd, I know. See, when I hear stuff like that, I know that nobody has any real criticism of what I'm saying because what I'm saying is true. If all you can say is, you know what he's doing in his one-man show? It's all about one man. It's like,
well, how did you decide as you were putting this show together what stories you wanted to tell about your life? There's a lot of stuff I had no idea about that you talked about.
Wanted to tell stories that showed how I learned starting at an early age as a teenager that one person can make a difference, and that's not just a cliche. It really is true. And I experienced it starting at the age of 17, where something I did in Michigan, made it on the CBS Evening News. And then the next year, I became one of the youngest people ever to be elected to office. When 18-year-olds were given the right to vote, a few months later, I got elected in Michigan. And I never would have thought that could have happened. I share these stories with the audience to say, and other people I've seen do things that have made huge changes in this world simply because they woke up one morning and said, damn it, I'm tired of this, or I'm going to do something about it. You know, as much as you're told that you're a nobody from nowhere, that is the biggest lie. You are actually somebody. You are from somewhere. And what you are is scary to those who run the show. Those in charge, the elite, you know, the upper whatever it is, the 1%, their biggest fear is that the 99% are going to realize they actually do hold the power.
Who do you think could beat Trump in 2020?
It would have to be a well-known, beloved American. I think we have to run TV against TV or run a movie star against Trump, the TV star. I know a lot of people listening to an NPR station probably go, oh, no, please, no, we need some, we need somebody. Who,
we need a radio host. That's what we need.
Well, yeah. Radio host would be kind of cool.
Terry Gross.
Terry Gross, right. Yes, absolutely. No, we need to run Tom Hanks. I want to run a beloved American that people are going to vote for. Oprah would win. Everybody knows Oprah would win. Michelle Obama would win. Oh, my God. She's not going to run. But that's the way Democrats need to start thinking. Not thinking about, you know, which wonky senator or representative or whatever. We got to think outside the mainstream of political people. I mean, first of all, Trump has proven anybody can get elected president. So if now we know that's the truth, we have a whole bunch of, we don't have to run just anybody. We could actually run somebody that could win.
Michael Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you. And thank you, NPR. We need you now more than ever.
Our interview with Michael Moore aired last October. His new documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9, opens in theaters on September 21st.
Prosecutors in the trial of President Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, tried again today to get Judge T.S. Ellis to walk back comments. Now, the judge has been writing prosecutors to hurry up the trial, criticizing their evidence. Yesterday, he had to apologize to the jury for a criticism that turned out to be wrong. But also yesterday, Judge Ellis interrupted a prosecutor questioning a witness about Manafort's attempts to get a loan, which was later rejected. The judge said, focus on loans that were granted. Emily Bazelon is staff writer for the New York Times and fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, the prosecutor, as you know, said the fact that Manafort sought the loan constituted conspiracy. They want the jury to ignore the judge's comments. And they're concerned he may be influencing this trial. What's your take? Many judges run a tight ship.
Right. This judge, though, seems particularly tyrannical, and it is mostly coming out against the prosecution. And so I think the prosecutors are getting worried that he's conveying a kind of sense to the jury that there are problems with their case that don't actually exist. And that's why they want what's called a curative instruction about this question regarding the testimony on the loan. They want the judge to say that he made a mistake and that that testimony was, in fact, relevant.
But curative instruction. Who does that? How does that happen?
Well, the judge can say to the jury, as he did already this week, you know what? I messed up. Mm-hmm. I lambasted the prosecutors, but actually I had given them permission to do the thing I was criticizing for them. That was what happened earlier. So they want another instruction like that.
Well, and he's the decider as to whether or not to do that. Well, at one point, this judge told prosecutors, look at me, don't look down, don't roll your eyes. It's like they're children. He told the prosecutor that he was crying at one point, and the prosecutor said, no, I'm not. I mean, it sounds odd. Last year, a defendant appealed a guilty verdict from the judge on the grounds that Judge Ellis, the defendant, felt had interfered too much. The appeals court disagreed, saying he interrupted both sides equally. You know, are you looking now? The prosecution may not get to rest today, but when they do and defense comes up, will you be looking for that to see if he also treats the defense that way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the most important quality of a judge is to be even-handed. So that's absolutely crucial. You know, look, a lot of judges like to exercise their power, but you want to make sure you're doing it in a way that is accurate and fair, and that you don't want your kind of fighting or sparring with the lawyers to become the main event. The main event is the evidence and the proof they're putting on.
Well, and of course, you know, part of what's happening here is this is the age-old bugaboo we can't see because these federal trials are not televised. You know, your thoughts on what that would do. Some say that it would just kind of make it too sensational, this very, very serious process of a federal trial.
Well, I just couldn't agree with you more. I mean, this is a trial there's a lot of interest in. We should be able to see for ourselves how Judge Ellis is behaving, how strong the government's proof is, how good the defense is. We should be able to make those judgments ourselves. And it's really a huge shame that this this proceeding isn't televised.
Yeah, especially since it's so fascinating. We will keep following it. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, fellow at Yale Law School, on the judge at the center of the Manafort trial, getting a lot of copy himself. Emily, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The midterm elections are less than 3 months away. Are you registered to vote? Are you sure that your name hasn't been purged from the voter rolls? The Brennan Center at the NYU School of Law published a report last month that examines the extent of voter roll purges around the country and finds that 16 million people were removed from voter rolls between 2014 and 2016. That is a significant uptick from the decade before. Now the center is in the process of suing multiple states over what it says are voting rights violations. Joining us now is Mirna Perez, who is a lawyer who works on voting rights at the Brennan Center and co-author of the report. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And give us the headline. What did you find here?
We found that purges are happening across the country at an increased rate. And importantly, they are happening at an outpaced increased rate in states that were formerly covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was weakened by the Supreme Court in the 2013 Shelby County decision. So at a time where we have fewer federal protections than we've had in the better part of 50 years, more and more states and localities are purging voters.
And part of that is because of laws in some of these places where they're actually forcing the state to do that, right?
There's a confluence of events that are happening all at the wrong time. We have some states that are enacting policies or laws that are disenfranchising voters because of the increased number of people being purged as a result of these laws. We have some activist groups that are putting pressure on states and localities to more aggressively purge voters. And then we have these new databases that are being used supposedly to help clean up the rolls, but if not being used properly, they can lead to people being erroneously purged. We're also seeing this occur against a backdrop where there's an increasing amount of rhetoric about fraud, which is making voters nervous about the integrity of our elections, when what we actually need to be concerned about is eligible people having unnecessary and unhelpful barriers in front of the ballot box.
You call some of these purges illegal. Why?
Right. Well, there are federal and state laws that govern how election administrators are allowed to clean the rolls. There are federal and state protections. And in the course of our study, we found a number of states had conducted purges that were illegal. And importantly, we found a few states that have policies on the books that would authorize an illegal purge. We are actually suing the state of Indiana because they have an illegal purge practice, and very recently we had a court forbid them from proceeding with that practice until there was more study and more evidence before the court. And we've sent notice to two other states that are also undertaking the same procedure that we expect them to not be purging voters in violation of federal law. So I think the most important thing for your listeners are not to panic, but to actually check to see if they're registered and to help the people in their community, the people they care about, the people in their family, to make sure that they're registered. Mm-hmm. And if it turns out that they're not on the rolls and they believe that they should be, they need to sound the alarm. They need to call the election administrator, find out what happened. They need to, you know, let the Brennan Center know so we can look into it. We want election administrators to clean our rolls. We want them to be accurate. We want them to be up to date. But we can't have these sloppy, haphazard practices that are removing eligible voters without any protection.
Well, let me ask you about Ohio, because Ohio is a use it or lose it state. So if you don't vote, you're removed after you've received a notice. The Secretary of State there said in 2016 that his goal was to strike the balance between making it easy to vote and hard to cheat, and that it was his job to make sure that voting rolls stay up to date and are not bloated, as he said, with voters who have passed away or left the state. So how do you respond to that argument?
He is right in that it is 100% his responsibility to strike an appropriate balance between keeping the polls accessible to eligible voters and removing bloat. He was taken into court because a group of voters in Ohio felt that Ohio's policy of removing voters was too aggressive and was contrary to federal law. A Supreme Court decision agreed that Ohio's policy was lawful, but that should not be interpreted as a green light for everyone else to haphazardly purge.
Do you think it has been interpreted that way?
I think it was recent enough that it's too early to tell. And we have been very, very clear that the Supreme Court affirmed a number of the important protections that we see being violated. And one thing your listeners should be aware of is that Ohio's policy was an outlier. So what you need to be on the lookout for is states that had a policy that was more voter friendly than Ohio switching to a policy like Ohio. But we have not seen that kind of turn just yet. But again, it's still too early.
Do you think that there are legitimate reasons to purge voters from the rolls?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We want people who are dead to be removed from the rolls. We want people who have moved to be removed from the rolls. We want people who are have been made ineligible because of a criminal conviction or because of an adjudication of mental incapacitation to be removed from the rolls. Everybody should agree that only those who are eligible to vote should be on the rolls. What we don't want are purge practices that are sloppy, haphazard, done in secret, and in violation of federal and state law. And everyone benefits when our rolls are clean, but eligible voters are harmed when, in the efforts to clean them, election administrators get too aggressive or sloppy.
One of the things that we've been hearing from President Trump is that there are a lot of non-citizens who are voting. What have you found in that regard as you've looked into this?
I mean, that's an excellent question and gives us a good opportunity to do some needed public education. There is a very big difference between non-citizens getting on the rolls and non-citizens actually voting. There are a lot of reasons that folks who are not eligible might end up on voter rolls through no pernicious or malicious reason, through a mistake, because someone misinformed them, and the like. As far as people who are non-citizens actually voting, it was really disappointing to see the president make that kind of statement because it is false. We actually did a study shortly thereafter where we went to election administrators that were the most likely to see large numbers of non-citizens voting. And even casting a very wide net, even looking very far in advance, we just found a handful of folks who may have been non-citizens that actually voted. And obviously, we want that number to be as small as possible. But like anything in life, the response needs to be proportionate to the harm, and it actually needs to fix it. And all of this fear mongering, all of this really racialized language is not constructive to fixing the problems that we have in election administration. We should, as Americans, be very worried about Russian criminals interfering with our elections. We should be very worried about that. We should be very worried that election administrators don't have the kinds of resources that they need to make sure that the polls go smoothly on election day. We should be very worried that folks are going to be conducting sloppy purges. And we should be very worried about the millions of Americans who are eligible to vote but are not registered because they're disgusted with what they see as a political system where folks are just, you know, harping at each other and not actually proposing solutions. So there's a lot of room for improvement in how we administer our elections, but vilifying a segment of the population when there is no data supporting it and when there's in fact contrary data is really irresponsible and unconstructive.
Myrna, we are about 90 days away from the midterm elections, which means that no voter roll purges can legally be carried out between now and then. Do you think, though, that voter roll purges are going to affect the upcoming midterms?
I think we need to be on the lookout for it. I think we need to be mindful of the policies that have been put in place prior to the 90 days that we're not going to see till the elections. But importantly, the folks that vote in midterms tend to be what we call super voters. They tend to be people that are really active. We're going to see the consequences of an aggressive and improper purge most likely on election day. So I, for one, would be happy to get some glimmers of something that might have suggested that there was a problem that we need to fix, so we have some time to fix it before the election. But for the most part, if there were problematic purges, we'll see them on election day.
That is Myrna Perez, who is a lawyer who works on voting rights at the Brennan Center and a co-author of a report that we will link you to at hereandnow.org. Myrna, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Transbay Transit Center cost more than $2 billion to build and will eventually connect the city's buses, BART subway system, and other regional trains. It will also include a terminal for a planned high-speed rail to Los Angeles, but that's at least 10 years away. In fact, this weekend's opening is largely symbolic. Buses are operating out of the terminal, but trains and subway are still years away, and there's a flashy gondola. It's not yet operational, though. Still, there's lots of excitement. Tilly Chang is executive director of the San Francisco County Transportation Authority. She joins us by Skype. Tilly, this is a huge building, only five stories tall, but it stretches five city blocks along Mission Street, and it features this rooftop garden. Describe the building for us.
So we've got the ground floor, the basement, that is the rail hub, you know, where the trains are coming in the basement. And then we've got the mezzanine, and we've got the ground floor retail. We've got layers for AC transit, our regional bus systems. And then on the top, this magnificent rooftop park. So it's been thoughtfully designed. It's iconic in its design, and it's graceful. I think it really kind of knits that urban fabric, which is otherwise quite a, you know, a concrete sort of jungle with, you know, office buildings and the like. And it creates this beautiful, light, airy, you know, the exterior is this really decorative mesh, unique pattern. And it provides a really nice, I think, enhancement to the neighborhood.
Talk about, I mean, people hear $2 billion. It reminds me of when we had the Ted Williams Tunnel and this huge infrastructure built here in the Boston area. These things cost money. Why? Why $2
billion? Why is it $2 billion? Infrastructure is not inexpensive. It does take investment. And that is exactly how we view this. It's a tremendous investment for the city, for the region, and for the state, because it will be connecting over a dozen regional and statewide transit systems and creating a beautiful new space that anchors really a whole district land use plan.
It sounds like you want to make people think of public transportation as communal.
Exactly. That I couldn't put it better myself. I think this is a transportation facility, but it is so much more. It is a neighborhood gathering place. It will have community spaces. It's a regional destination. It's going to have really unique offerings as far as retail. We're going to have, you know, fitness classes up there that are free and open to the public, so that we can all benefit both at the local and at the regional level.
And you are thinking long term, because I understand there's a whole portion of it that's going to be empty for like 10 years?
Yes, we hope it won't be 10 years, but it could be up to 10 years. We understand that that's a long time, and folks have been waiting, you know, eagerly for the rail connection. I can say that we have just, through our board action at the Transportation Authority, allocated $10 million to advance the design. We're positioned for the federal funding. We're just finishing up the environmental. So there's a ways to go with the design and the funding plan to get to construction, but we're all committed to doing so, and we'll continue to move that along as we refine the cost estimates through design.
Well, and again, some of the criticism was of the ballooning spending, but it sounds as if you hope the payoff is what?
So the payoff is more than just, it's certainly mobility and easy, convenient connections for travelers to connect to Los Angeles. This has an economic benefit that is incredibly important, because the 101 highway corridor between San Francisco, San Mateo, and San Jose is very, very congested. It's like the top three, within the top three of most congested links in our region. So certainly as a congestion management investment, but also to focus development and to realize that transit-oriented development. That's the housing, the affordable housing, the commercial development as well. The land use benefits are tremendous. There's 25,000 jobs that are being created through the building program at the terminal itself and the eventual downtown extension of rail. But you can already see from all the development that's already happened, it's been transformational.
Have you heard from other cities? I mean, New York, those, I'm a New Yorker, New York, which took down one of the most beautiful train stations in the world, Penn Station, and put an ugly, you know, mall on top of it. And the trains are all subterranean, and it's just really horrendous. And they are now going, you know, trying to go back to where they were 50, 60 years ago. Have you been hearing from other cities, you know, this is the direction we need to go in? Don't keep our transportation in kind of a dank area where it's not fun to go to.
Right. Oh, yeah. We get study tours all the time from around the country, even around the world. They come not only for the transit center design itself, but really how it's a model of finance and innovative sort of integrated planning. So it's the land use piece, it's the transportation piece, but it's also the public finance. It's very hard to finance these major infrastructure investments.
Well, Tilly Chang, you have an open house, a block party this weekend. Yeah, what will people do? Just like come in and get on a bus? Or what will they do?
Yeah, we hope they'll come in and they'll tour around this beautiful facility. The architecture is stunning. The terrazzo plan on the floor on the first level is beautiful. There's some retail pop-up stores. You can take elevators and escalators up to the rooftop park. And we're hopeful that eventually in about a month, the gondola will be open, and that will provide a fast way up from the street to the rooftop.
Tilly Chang, Executive Director of the San Francisco County Transportation Authority. It looks beautiful. Best with it this weekend. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Poor Penn Station.
I'm sorry.
Everybody loves to hate on Penn Station. No, it's true. Deserved. It's here and now.